Welcome to Smart Talk. I' Scott Lamar. 75 years ago today, U.S. Marines were fighting one of the bloodiest battles of World War II on the tiny South Pacific island of Iwo Jima.
What's the matter? Hey, pull out!
Over 36 days in February and March 1945, Marines fought a few feet at a time to defeat 20,000 Japanese soldiers. Lancaster County native George Okap was one of those Marines. Mr. Okap is 94 years old. He joins us to share his experiences at Iwo Jima. George Okap, I have to say it's an honor to meet you today.
Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. That broadcast you heard, that was a live radio broadcast. It was live at the time. Is it what it sounded like on Iwo Jima?
Definitely. Definitely.
I mean,
and worse.
Obviously, we had to turn it down. I mean, what was the noise like?
Oh, that was terrific. With the battleships, you know, shelling the island ahead of us, you know, and it was just terrible with sound. Yeah. Right.
Well, let's go back to a much more peaceful time before Iwo Jima, and you were drafted and went into the Marines. But you grew up in southern Lancaster County, right?
Yes, I did.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Providence Township. That's near Quarryville.
And you went to high school. At that time, it was Quarryville High School. I guess today
yes,
would be
was.
Solanco. But
that's correct. That's correct.
So what did you do? I mean, were you, you went in the Marines?
Well, before I went into the Marines, I was a regular farm boy, as you say, and I was inducted. I was drafted, and I didn't go in on my own. But I went to Harrisburg. That's where we went as a group, and we were divided up. Some went to the Army, some went to the Navy, and there was three of us at last sitting there waiting to see where we were going to go. And the first thing they said, well, you're in the Marines. So off to Philadelphia we went from there for the day, for the night.
So did any of the people who were separating you into the three branches of service, did they ask you where you wanted to go?
Nope, nothing. Nope. It was strictly you, and you. That was a time when they were really drafting hard to get people into the service.
Yeah, this was 1944?
44.
So why did they choose you to go to the Marines?
Have no idea, but I was in good health. I don't know if that was in it, but anyway, that's where we ended up.
Did you have a preference when you went in?
Not necessarily, but I was glad I did get in the Marines. Mm.
But now, the Marines fought mostly in the South Pacific.
Sure.
Did you know from the time when you said you went to Philadelphia, right after they decided which branch of service you were going to be going into, did you know that you probably were going to see action?
Well, the way they were forcing people through training, yes, I figured we were headed for action. Yes, I did. Especially at Paris Island, when you know that's where you first got your basic
boot camp. Yeah.
Yeah, boot camp work. But then you went into the advanced, which was Camp Lejeune, and that's where you got into your real training.
What was boot camp like?
Boot camp, that was more discipline and things of that sort. That was, you know what I mean. That was from daylight till dark, you were training, you know what I mean.
Yeah,
drilling, running, it was just everything, yeah. But then when you went to Camp Lejeune, then it was in the real training of warfare, you know what I mean, yeah.
You were trained as a flamethrower, right? Using a flamethrower. Was that from the very beginning? How did they decide on that?
No, sir. That was after we left the States and we went to Hawaii. That's where we got into the flamethrower training.
So you had kind of the same training as everyone else before you got to Hawaii.
Yeah, basic training and advanced training. That's right.
So then from Camp Lejeune, you go to Hawaii.
Nope. We went from there to San Diego.
Oh, okay.
And there we were placed upon a boat out of San Diego to Hawaii. And then that's where we were then more or less grouped into the flamethrower group, which consisted of a BAR man and
Browning automatic rifle.
That's exactly right. And a demolition man, and that's where we trained together.
I have to admit that when I see those videos of flamethrowers, I also often think to myself, wow.
Yes.
That is, I mean, for the enemy, that's a heck of a way to go. But I have to imagine that those who operated flamethrowers like yourself would be targets of the enemy.
Definitely so. You are definitely a target. But thank God I got through it with that, yeah.
So how did you get to Iwo Jima?
How to get to Iwo Jima? Well, we had on the flamethrower at Maui. That's where we trained with the flame and the group. From there, we went then to Saipan. That's where we really formed the operation to go on to Iwo Jima. And that's where we got all the equipment. You got on the boats there, the big ships, the ones that had the big, I don't know them. They had a name for them, but I don't know. LM something. LM something,
yeah.
But I don't know the exact.
Little landing crafts is
what
they were.
Well, this was the bigger one. Then they come to the smaller ones, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So when you went to Saipan, did you know that the mission would be Iwo Jima?
We were starting to be, yes. We were starting just, we were hearing it scuttlebutt, you know. But once we got on the board, we got, then that's where we were leaving for Iwo Jima. That's when we really got told where we were going, what was the operation and all of that, yeah.
So you're on the boat, and the seas are rough.
Yep.
What kind of intelligence did they give you? I mean, did they give you numbers of how many Japanese soldiers are there? I mean, originally, from what I understand, they thought that American forces, because you had like 60,000, could take these 20,000 Japanese soldiers in like 5 days.
6 days. Six days was our goal.
6 days was the goal.
That's what we were told, 6 days that we were to take that island.
And it ended up being 36 days.
Yes.
And there were very few Japanese soldiers left. But as you're on that boat about to enter combat for the first time, you were 18 or were you 19?
Yes, 18.
What's going through your mind?
I'll tell you. It's everything. But you know, you listen to what the instructions were and what was all of this map laying out and things. You listened. You listened to him.
When you say everything, I mean things back home, things about family.
Yes, that all goes through your mind. That all goes through your mind.
I mean, it's. I know this is a dumb question, but how afraid, how scared, how frightened were you?
You don't seem as bad as you are as when it's the time that they put you on that amphibious tractor and send you out those doors. That's when it really gets serious.
Because there are shots around you.
No. Not when you go out of that big ship. You're out about a mile.
Oh, okay. So you're that far
shore.
Out. Okay.
Oh, yeah. You're that far out from shore. Mm-hmm. But till they get you in them with the full, like the flamethrower on and all the other fellows with their packs and stuff on, you're put into that amphibious tractor thing. And it takes you down a ramp. The big doors open, and you see the ocean right down there. And then the steel wheels and the tractor spinning to get you on the water level, you know. That's a thrill. It's a thrill.
Thrill, but at the same time, you say
that's when you start thinking. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when that door dropped and you got your first look at the island of Iwo Jima, what did it look like?
Well, when you were out there, it looked like one big whale, with the Suribachi being the tail and the way the shape of the island. It just looked like one big whale laying out there. That's what it looked like.
Mm. Yeah. So when you say that, with the colors, I mean, what did I know that it's like dark sand, the beach is dark.
Yeah, well, it was all mixed. The sand was mixed, dark and light and everything, yeah.
So how long did it take you to get from the boat on the half track to the beach?
I would say that mile, half, 20 minutes to something like that, 20 minutes to half an hour, something like that. Yeah,
that's longer than I thought.
Yeah, it is.
That's a lot of time to think.
Yes, it is. Yep. But we got out there until we formed with the other tractors. See, there was a group, maybe six or seven tractors, and till they got all formed and then got the word when to move in. Yeah.
So when did you said you were about a mile out when the landing craft opened the door? When did you start seeing shots coming from the enemy?
It was quiet till we got in there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They just waited for us to get onto the island.
So when you didn't get shot at until there were actually, you were on the beach?
We were on the beach. That's when it was. Then it was to get up over to the top of the sand from the ocean, you know. That they had that crisscross fire. And you just couldn't get over that.
Mm. What do you mean crisscross? I mean, obviously I know what crisscross means, so there were Japanese on one side, on the right and on the left. And
that's what they were doing.
And you're caught in the middle.
You're caught in the middle. Right. That's where we lost a lot of boys, too, that way.
Mm. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Yeah, you're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. You can see some of the shows that we're working on, such as Pennsylvania's plan to defend against the coronavirus with State Secretary of Health Dr. Rachel Levine. That's coming up on Monday. And also Real ID. There's a lot of confusion surrounding Real ID. We will address that on next week's program, one of next week's program as well. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. Today we're talking with what's 75th anniversary of 36-day battle of Iwo Jima, small Pacific island. We're talking with an Iwo Jima veteran who's from Lancaster County, George Ocamp. And if you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mr. Ocamp, we had a question from a listener asking, were all the divisions landing simultaneously?
No.
No?
No. It's just the 5th and the 3rd Marine or 4th Marine Division.
And you were in the 4th, right?
Well, I was in the 4th Marine Division. And the third Division was held in reserve out there behind us.
So you've told your story up until now. You just got to the beach. So you get to the beach on Iwo Jima. What do you see? What do you hear? What do you feel?
You're scared skinny. They're scared skinny. There's no doubt about that. But when you can't move, you're just dug. You just in the sand. When they would bomb, when they would drop mortars in, the sand was such that the mortar went down in, and it come up more or less like this. If it would have been stony, solid ground, I figured the Marines would have never got on the island. That solid.
So you have your comrades, lousy word, colleagues all around you, and so what's going on around you? As this is happening, these mortars are coming. Is there machine gun fire at this time coming from the Japanese?
They were firing. That's what I was saying. It's the crossfire that they played with it, which we just couldn't get off the beach. We just couldn't get up onto it.
So I assume you're on your belly.
Yeah. On your belly. That's everybody's on their belly. Mm-hmm.
Were there friends, colleagues, around you who were injured, maybe even killed?
Yes, that seemed as after, well, from whatever shrapnel or anything that was flying, you know, from the mortars, yes. But anyway, as we moved, as we did, we were supposed to get to the airfield within the first day. Well, we never even got near that till the sixth day, up to the airfield from mm-hmm. the beach up to here.
How far away? You have a map in front of you.
Yeah.
Here. How far was the airfield away from
well,
the beach
that
where you
there
landed?
Was that was a good, I would say 1,000 feet. Might have been 1,000 feet.
And it took 6 days.
It took us 6 days.
To get those 1,000 feet.
Well, now, there was other Marines that was making headway. But I, being a flamethrower man, you're held back to when you're needed. You see what I mean? For to pull out a, burn out a pillbox or anything that they needed.
Well, you just touched on this, but what was the job of a flamethrower?
Flamethrower man was, he was with a BAMR man, like I told you, and mm-hmm. a demolition man. And the BAR man was to kind of protect the flamethrower man. Mm. And that was the purpose for that. And that's when we were called up to take something, that's what it was for.
Now, did you have a sidearm or any other weapon with you?
I had a 45. That's all I had on. That was my weapon, a 45.
So the flamethrower and the 45.
45.
So I understand that there was another flamethrower who was, his job was to take out a pillbox before you.
Yeah. And he unfortunately got killed.
What happened?
He got shot through the head. They told me, I didn't see it, but I was told that's what happened to him.
These pillboxes, where were they in relationship to the beach?
they were just scattered. There were a lot of them on the right of us. That's when we were going up to the island. We were going up here. They were over, the pillboxes was in this area here. And we were in a type of this. That's the type of...
Mr. Okamp's pointing to a picture here of a little hilly area.
Yes.
This photograph looks like kind of a Polaroid of Iwo Jima. Now, that's not your unit, but
that's
just
another
like
unit. I made that aware of that. That's another unit.
Yeah, it's kind of dark.
But it's similar to what I was situated.
But very hilly.
Only thing, I went around with the same kind of a similar mound, but I came in from this side.
From the
over
right
here.
Side.
Yeah, from the right side.
So,
yeah.
But this pillbox, could you see the pillbox? You said you didn't
it's
see
it. Just
your...
like this, if you're this. But then, right. There was an opening. There was an opening.
So you heard that the other flamethrower before you had been killed.
Yeah.
So you get the order.
Yeah.
Then
I
what?
Got called up to take this.
Then what?
Well... I did what I was supposed to. I hated to do it, you know, take another man's life. But hey, it's you were here on that situation.
Were you being shot at?
Oh yes, it was being shot at. But I, fortunate enough, I had a good BAR man that limited the fire a little.
Mm-hmm. So
till I got situated to flamethrower.
So you took out the pillbox. What? How? You know, I'm curious as to how long those flamethrowers last. Because I mean, obviously mm-hmm. there's fuel there.
Yes.
What makes up the fuel for the
fuel is 100% high octane gasoline and napalm that you prepare beforehand, which naturally you have to do. In a 55-gallon drum, you take and you put so much gasoline and so much napalm, and you stir it that it makes almost like a jelly, but thin jelly, you know. And then with your pressure tanks, you have two pressure tanks in the back with one fuel tank, and that's right here. You can put your...
Yeah, there's a picture. Yeah, there's a picture of a flamethrower.
Yeah.
So you said that you hated to take another man's life. I'm sure that's something that was going through your mind all through training, but especially once you hit that beach.
Once you get this, yes. This is the
what were you thinking?
Well, it's either you or he. That's the only thing that you can think about at the time, you know. But you just gotta do your job.
And what do you think afterwards?
What do you do? Yeah. I was glad to get rid of my flamethrower. That's all I can say afterwards.
Oh, that so yeah. The tank was empty.
Yeah, the tank was empty.
And you were. Why were you glad to get rid of it?
Well, because you always had the idea that that's what they were looking for, and if you got shot on that in the back, you burn up. You burned up. That's all.
Yeah. So once you took out that pillbox and you got rid of the flamethrower, then what? Where did you go?
Well, then you pick up a rifle that somebody else, got killed with, and you pick that up.
And you become another infantry soldier.
You just keep going from mortar hole to mortar hole. That's how we worked our way up to the airfield.
I want to take a phone call from Thomas in Lancaster. Thomas, you're on the air.
Hi. A question for the gentleman. What particular unit was he in? Which battalion, which regiment?
I was in the 4th Marine Division, 23rd Marines, A Company.
So Alpha 423.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. No, did you have another question?
I was wondering if he was on the island, sir, if you were on the island when they started landing U.S. planes once the battle was over.
No, sir, I was not. I was only on 8 days when I got hit.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Thomas. So, okay, you just said when you got hit.
Mm-hmm.
So you were on the island for 8 days. Is there fighting going on after it's dark, too?
Well, they send flares up to keep this. That way you can see if the enemy's moving in on you or anything of that sort.
The Marines sent up the flares.
Yeah, flares. They send up flares.
Were they moving?
It was amazing. I can say that we didn't run into any Japanese that was pushing in on us at that time. Yeah, at the Indian night time.
So I'm curious how much you got to see of actual Japanese soldiers during those 8 days.
Well, I can't say I seen too many. Maybe a couple that was killed on the way up there. But see, I was in around the airfield, and that's where I got. Getting ahead of my story.
Now, okay, well, what you're talking about is you were wounded. Yeah. What happened?
Well, right after I was done with the flamethrowers, and we got, like I told you, as a rifleman then, and then I got assigned a sergeant Trunin. I'll always remember him. He was a heck of a nice guy. He ordered me to get a stretcher. He got word that our boys up here behind the airfield was pinned down, and there was a lot of them killed. And he sent me up the airfield with a stretcher, folding stretcher, and to go to recover some of these men. Well, when I was going up the airfield, they were shooting at me, but I got to a place where there was a shell hole, and I dove in it. My stretcher was sticking up. They were shooting at it. So I went to get out. After I was in the hole, I went to look out to see where I was to go to get somebody. Well, that's when a mortar went off right out in front of me.
How far out in front of you?
I would say maybe 20 feet. Something like that. But that was up where the harder ground was. So you got this.
So there were stones and the ground.
And that's where I got hit in the face.
You got hit in the face.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you. You can't tell.
Can't you see the white spot?
Okay. All right.
That's where.
We're on radio. There is a white spot. But so did you know you were badly wounded?
Yes. Because it just seemed like my jaw, I couldn't get my mouth open or shut. I could put a straw between my teeth. It acted that quick, but I was all over blood. Sergeant Dovin, he came up, Joe in the hole beside me, and he seen I was hit, and he says, you know, get the hell out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I was scared worse then to think of going back down the airfield.
Well, you see, that's what I was thinking about, too, is that just because you're leaving the area doesn't mean that you're not a target.
Nope.
You were still being shot at.
Still being shot at, but I was gone and scared so bad that I couldn't have told how close or what they were, but I didn't get hit that way. There come the Jeep to recover, to pick up the stretcher fellows, which we didn't have. He saw that what the shape I was in. He got me in the Jeep and took me back down and got me as close to shore as he could, because you can't get a Jeep in soft soil to go down to the. So I did walk from there. A corpsman came and seen I was hit down at the shore. Come and got me and walked me down to the barge that they put the wounded on. And there was dead soldiers, dead Marines laying on the shore there in ponchos.
You were able to walk.
I was able to
not
walk.
Not talk, though.
No, not talk. That later happened that I got worse with it, and my tongue would go out to the opposite side of my mouth. I had difficulty eating and everything. Mm. Yeah.
So, I mean, you're still lean. Did you lose weight after that?
Yeah. Yes, I did.
I'll bet you
did. Yeah. I went down to, I got put aboard the hospital ship. Got aboard the hospital ship. And then from there, by a smaller boat to Saipan, back to the Saipan, the original base that we left. And then from there, I got my illness got worse. And that's when they sent me back to Hawaii, to the hospital in Hawaii. And that's where I spent some considerable time there.
So is that how you spent the rest of the war?
Well, not necessarily. I got sent from there after they saw that I could be in decent shape. They sent me to Corvallis, Oregon, to a naval hospital there. And that's where I was on limited duty guarding German soldiers. There was a camp, an army camp. Oh, I can't tell you how many miles, about 5 miles or something like that down the way from this one. And they had the soldiers, or the Germans, come there and work in the kitchens, doing odd jobs. And that's what I was in charge of, seeing that they were working and were on the job.
Mm. So how long before the end of the war then?
Well, that would have been we at Corvallis, Oregon, is where we celebrated, I'll put it that way. But I can't give you the dates and stuff of that.
Mm-hmm. That's fine.
Those are gone by.
It was a happy time, though, I'm sure.
It was a happy time. Then from there, I got sent from there to Quantico, Virginia, where then I was. Did some duty there till the time they got the papers and everything squared away.
And you went back to Lancaster County?
Back to Lancaster County. And that's my story.
We have several emails. Justin says, Mr. Ocamp, I cannot thank you for your service. Thank you enough for your service to this country. I'm curious how your integration back into civilian life was handled. Were your needs addressed when you came home?
Well, I'll put it this way. It was awful good to get back home, but it was still in your mind for a number of years. It is still.
A lot of World War II veterans didn't tell their stories for years. What about you?
You know, I didn't either at first. You just didn't feel that proud that you had to take somebody else's life. And I know the good Lord was looking over me. I had that feeling, and I give him credit to this day yet.
So when you say that after everything you went through, What you thought about most after the war, though, was that you had to take another person's life.
That bothered me. That bothered me.
Did you have nightmares or anything
like
that?
Yes. You couldn't sleep sometimes, you know what I mean. But my worst trouble was, I think, or not my worst, but the trouble was this shrapnel. I couldn't sleep on that side of my face. It was always jagging and bothered you.
You still have shrapnel.
Oh, yeah, I still have it there, yeah.
When you go to the dentist and get x-rays, do they, do they? They can still see it?
Yeah, probably do, yeah, I don't know.
Jenny from Millersville University asks, looking back, are you glad you were drafted and fought in the war? Do you think your life would have been better or worse without being drafted? And then she says, thank you for your service.
No. I can't say it would have bothered either way. I can't say. I don't think so.
Well, yeah. Were you glad that you were drafted and sent to the Marines?
Well, yes. I'm glad they give me the Marines because I wasn't, to be a sailor, I wasn't quite, I couldn't swim too good. And that was one of my worries that way, but yeah.
Well, I think there were a lot of people that went into the Navy who couldn't swim very well as well.
Yeah.
So what did you do once you got back to Lancaster County and lived your life?
Well, when I got back to Lancaster County, let's see, I got married. I got married to a lovely lady and had two children, my son with me here and a daughter, yeah.
Where did you work?
I worked at, really, my main work was, before I went in, I was at Hamilton Watch, but then that was a short time. And then I come home, I went with PPN. I got into painting and paper hand business, and then I went to PPNL, and that's where I've been for 34 years.
Mm.
34 years.
Well, Mr. Hocamp, and I echo everyone who has said this, but thank you for your service and coming on the program today. And I mean, when there's an anniversary like this and people are, and the media, focusing on this 75th anniversary, does it bring up any other memories for you, or do you just think, you're just thinking about it more often?
No. It was fading. It was fading. But this 75th, when I got contacted about the newspaper, why, it did. It started to bring some of the things back. I'm sure that there's other things that I could have, but I just, they're too faint to, yeah.
Well, you're 94 years old,
yes,
and I think
yes.
you're in really good shape. I mean, again, thank you very much for your service.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on Monday's program, Pennsylvania's plans to defend against the coronavirus with State Secretary of Health Dr. Rachel Levine. 100 years ago, in February 1920, the Negro National League was formed for African-American baseball players who weren't allowed to play in all-white Major League Baseball. It wasn't until Jackie Robinson joined the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947 that blacks played in the major leagues. But before that, some of the best players who ever played the game competed against one another in the Negro Leagues, including here in Harrisburg. The Susquehanna Art Museum's new exhibit, Separate and Unequal, celebrates the 100th anniversary of the Negro National League beginning on March 6th. And joining us today is one of the most renowned baseball historians, especially Negro League baseball historians anywhere, Ted Knorr. Ted is also manager of the other major league website. He's involved with so much. Ted, good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Here, let me put your microphone up there a little bit. All right. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so this 100th anniversary of the Negro National League, why is that significant?
Well, it's significant because without the Negro Leagues, we probably wouldn't have had Jackie in 1947. we'd have had them, but it might have been a few years later.
Black African Americans in America were playing baseball all the time, but was the Negro National League the first where it was organized, eight teams throughout the country?
It is the first successful organized league. There were a few others as far back as 1887 where there was attempts at putting an African American league together, and they didn't make it through their first month or so.
Mm-hmm. What was different about this one other than it lasted and was successful?
Well, the gentleman who was the first president of the league, the commissioner, was a gentleman named Rube Foster. And he was a spectacular pitcher, a player, manager, coach, promoter. So his leadership was important. And also in that room in 1920 was a gentleman named J.L. Wilkinson, who owned the Kansas City Monarchs. And he also was there at the beginning. So that's two Hall of Fame administrators in that very first meeting. That's a good start for a league.
You know, the one of the things that many people may not know is that Negro League teams, yes, they competed against one another, but they also played white teams as well.
Yeah, well, that's where they made their money, playing white, I'm going to call them town teams and semi-pro teams. But they did play major league teams, but after 1920, which is when the Negro League begins, a gentleman named Judge Landis, who, you know, saved baseball as the commissioner, him and Babe Ruth, coming off that 1919 scandal.
Chicago White Sox and the Black Sox, as it's known now.
Yeah, but the judge prohibited intact major league teams from playing Negro League teams, so we don't have a good measure of a full Negro League team and a full Major League team, but we do have hundreds of games of all-star Negro League teams versus all-star Major League teams, and many times actually carrying the name of the Brooklyn Dodgers or the Cincinnati Reds against a Homestead Grays. So there is a record.
Mm. I see you have a Pittsburgh Crawfords jersey on today. Homestead Grays were also in Pittsburgh.
That's right.
You know, some of these names that you bring up, baseball fans have gotten to know over the years because they had so many great players. Kansas City Monarchs had Satchel Paige, the great Hall of Fame pitcher. But, you know, some of these names we've heard over the years, but who, for those who aren't familiar, who were some of the best players in the Negro Leagues?
Well, right here in Harrisburg, we had an outfield in 1924 through 1927 that consisted of Fats Jenkins in left field, who is considered one of the 12 greatest Negro League outfielders by the Hall of Fame.
How does Fats Jenkins get his name?
it was a childhood name that stuck because he was by no means fat. He's in the Basketball Hall of Fame as a member of the Renaissance Five, which was a professional basketball team from the 30s. The right fielder in that outfield is Rap Dixon, who's my personal favorite, who is buried right here in, I think we're in Swatara Township.
Yes, yes.
And he has a marvelous grave, Midland Cemetery, if you ever get a chance. He belongs in the Hall. And the center fielder of that great outfield is in the Hall, and that's Oscar Charleston. And he has very few peers in any baseball league.
All right, I want to talk about Rap Dixon because I know that that is something that you have campaigned for a long time, to get Rap Dixon into the Hall of Fame. But let's talk about Oscar Charleston, because Oscar Charleston may not be the top of mind like Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, Jackie Robinson, those who are really good players, great players in Negro Leagues. But I've heard so many historians talk about Oscar Charleston and talk about how good of a player he was. Talk about Oscar Charleston.
Well, Charleston began his career before the Negro Leagues began in 1915, 1916, after service to our country in the armed forces. And he started as a pitcher, much like Ruth. They're both left-handed outfielders, and they both started as pitchers. But Charleston's career, he hits .350. So that gives you an idea against pitching that was every bit major league equivalent. He's on several championship teams, many as a manager. He was the manager of the Pittsburgh Crawfords. And he continues to play until the early 40s at a high level, and is managing at the time of his death in 1954. So he actually begins before the Negro Leagues and ends after their demise. Multi-talented player, a triple crown winner while here in Harrisburg. We enjoyed his best years. He was 27 when he first set foot on the Harrisburg Diamond. He wins back-to-back triple crowns in the Eastern Colored League. Unfortunately,
yeah, I just wanted to make that point that Harrisburg was not in the National League, but it was called the Eastern Colored League.
That's exactly right. That was the American League to the National League's National League, and they actually had World Series between those two leagues. And again, unfortunately, despite having the second best record over the 4 years that Harrisburg was in the league, they never finished first. They never made the World Series.
So Rap Dixon, as I said, this is you actually have a website of campaigning for Rap Dixon to get into the Hall of Fame. Why? What kind of player was he?
Well, first let me start with what others think of Rap. He was named in December of 2018 to the Centennial Team, which represents 100 years of Negro League baseball, the 32 best players and managers. There's only four players on that team who are not in the Hall. So it's really quite an honor, and I hope that honor might springboard him to the Hall of Fame. Why he belongs in? A great hitter, a five-tool player. His average is .326, and he also hit for power. His OPS, which we don't
get into. That's a combination of how often you get on base and
slugging.
And your power numbers, home runs, doubles, triples, that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's nobody in the Negro Leagues with a higher OPS and as many plate appearances as Rap Dixon. And there's only one major leaguer with those same numbers, and that's Lefty O'Doul, who's not in the Hall of Fame. So his statistics make it. And then defensively, he is the only Negro League outfielder who played left, center, and right, and has greater than average numbers for range, arm, and fielding percentage in left, center, and right. So he's a true five-tool player.
And he's buried here in Swatara Township in Dauphin County at Midland Cemetery.
Yes, and his grave is the most visited because we put a marker on there in 2006. God bless Steve Reed. So that marker attracts more visitors than any other grave, and it's a very well-visited cemetery because it's got some great soldiers buried there from the Civil War onto
the
present
day. One of the most historic cemeteries in all of central Pennsylvania at the Midland Cemetery. So before, because I want to talk about this before we leave the air today, this exhibit that's coming up at the Susquehanna Art Museum in Harrisburg that starts on March 6th, tell me about it.
Well, I'm very excited about it, and I was happy to be involved in it to the degree that I was. I gave the museum a list of maybe 10 or 12 artists that they could possibly get, and three of them are going to be here. There's a fourth, too, and that's a whole other story. But the three that are coming that I recommended are spectacular, and they're led by Dane Tillman, who's out of Exton, PA. And he's been doing Negro League art for well over 20 years, including Harrisburg Negro League art. So I'm anxious to see what, I think he has two pictures in the exhibit, so I'm anxious to see what he brings. The second person is a guy named Greg Kreindler, and he has over 200 of his works right now this year in the Negro League Museum in Kansas City, because he's done an excellent set of cards, including Rap Dixon on the Centennial Team. The third artist is a guy named Phil Dewey, and he's out of Detroit, or suburban Detroit, and he has a 7-foot Turkey Stearns picture that he's bringing. I was very excited
Turkey
to hear
Stearns?
That. Norman Turkey Stearns was an outfielder for the Detroit Stars and among other teams, probably almost the equal of Charleston.
I love these nicknames. You know, you don't hear too many guys named Turkey today or Fats nicknames today. But why is this important that You know, and the thing about this is, one of the reasons we're talking about it on this program is, this transcends sports. This transcends baseball. That, I mean, Jackie Robinson breaking the color line in 1947 Major League Baseball is looked to as one of the most iconic moments in the civil rights movement, changed this country. But why is this important that Americans learn about the history of Negro League Baseball?
Well, Jacques Barjon, who is a French-American historian, philosopher, he says to learn America, to understand America, you need to first learn baseball. And Jacques Barjon, by the way, was a graduate of Harrisburg Tech, so that's an interesting story, and he lived to be almost 100. But I believe that quote of his really sums it up. And baseball, if you like Ken Burns did in his marvelous PBS series, it really tells the story of America over the past 150 years. So if you want to know baseball, just to paraphrase Jacques, you really need to know the Negro Leagues, because in the first half of the 20th century, only a half, maybe 60%, maybe 40% of the best baseball was played in the American and the National Leagues.
Mm. Once Jackie Robinson integrated Major League Baseball, it took a while. I mean, the Phillies were the next to last team to have a black baseball player, and that was in the late 1950s. But once African Americans became part of the game, I mean, so many great athletes like Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, so many great players. Those kind of players were, I mean, a majority of American sports fans didn't get to see them.
That's right. That's right. The last victims of the segregation of baseball are us, right here. And that's what makes this show and shows like it so important, because we can name Babe Ruth, Roger Hornsby, Ty Cobb, you know, like we know our brothers and sisters, but we don't know the cool Papa Bells. And the like I mentioned, the Fats Jenkins, the Rev Kennedys, and players like that.
Mm. What was the name of the Harrisburg team in the Eastern Colored League?
Harrisburg Giants.
Did they go by the Harrisburg Black Giants?
They were called the Harrisburg Colored Giants in the early part of the 20th century, not really during their league period, but yes, they were the Harrisburg Colored Giants.
Why only 4 years?
Well, the league only begins 4 years before that, so there wasn't, and the Eastern Colored League is only 1 year old when Harrisburg joins. The league kind of met a demise 1927 while it was bustling in the country. We were 2 years.
And Babe Ruth hitting 60 home runs.
Yeah, oh yeah, and John Beckwith hitting at least 60 for Harrisburg that year in the total schedule. Marshall Waters, the bat boy, told me that, and he should know. Mm-hmm. But now I forget the question.
We were just talking about why only 4 years.
Oh, yeah. And the league itself had a demise there after the 27th season. Harrisburg wasn't going to be in 28, but the league kind of fell apart. That team was the first team to be wholly owned by a single African-American individual. And it was the highest paid team in black baseball in 1927. So you can understand it was kind of difficult for Mr. Struthers, who's another topic, to continue on year after year.
We only have about 30 seconds left. And Ted, I want to thank you very much for being on with us today. But just in the time that Ted Knorr has been on the program, just listen to hear the history that Harrisburg has had with Negro League Baseball, with African-American players, just incredible. And there's so much more to learn. The exhibit is coming up at the Susquehanna Art Museum starting on March 26th. Ted Knorr, thank you very much. And I hope that everyone gets on board with Rap Dixon going to the baseball
hall. There you go.
And websites. You have websites.
Well, I have two Facebook pages.
Oh, okay.
One for Rap and one for the Negro Leagues in general.
Okay. And there's a lot to learn there, so I encourage you to go. But Ted, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on Monday's show, just wanted to mention this. I know there was a lot of information about the coronavirus. We will find out what Pennsylvania is doing to try to fight or defend against the coronavirus, the spread of coronavirus here in Pennsylvania. The Secretary of Health will be on the program coming up on Monday. Have a good weekend.